This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Taxis in bus lanes to our callers ringing in, having a go at me. Serious news stories, bit of banter. It's all in the mix of a typical Nolan show, and that's what we have today on this podcast. I'm freezing, I've got to say, so I'm not sure if I'll be here in the morning. You see, if I was Brendan, who works on the Nolan show, what he does is he says, "Not feeling very well," and then he goes, "Ah-ha." Then he's off for a month. So who knows when you'll ever see me again. Hope you enjoyed today's podcast.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, the 30th of January. Here comes the Nolan Show from the BBC. At the moment, bus lanes, it's the likes of Bruce Street, Dublin Road, Great Victoria Street, Shaftesbury Square, have been opened up to most taxis. But the head of Translink is saying that he has concerns about taxis, more taxis being allowed to use bus lanes in Belfast. If you remember back to all the malarkey, all the outcry of how traffic was gridlocked in Belfast city centre, in December, Stormont's Department for Infrastructure made the decision in an effort to ease traffic congestion, opening up some of those bus lanes to taxis. Let's have a listen to what Translink's Chris Conway said when he was speaking at Stormont's Infrastructure Committee yesterday.
I think in terms of taxis and bus lanes, I have to take the... Not too many comments on that. You know, I have concerns about it, but I understand why the minister had to make that decision at the point in time he did it. We haven't seen a big. It's only a small number of bus lanes around Grand Central Station. At this point, we haven't seen a big impact. I think the pilot needs to go for over a period of time before you could really assess, you know, whether there was a positive or a negative impact. I know cyclists are concerned about it because obviously bus lanes are also used for cyclists as well, and that's one of the concerns from a safety perspective. But I think we're on a view. Look, let's wait and see and see how it works out.
Right. So let us know what you think this morning. So Translink saying they have concerns, but at the same time, they're saying, well, so far it hasn't had much impact. So you could look at that both ways, couldn't you? Pat the taxi driver, regular on the Nolan Show at the very top of the programme this morning, because you can tell us, Pat, your experience, how's it played out?
It hasn't made any difference, Stephen, to the traffic. And the thing about it is...
I'm not sure, therefore we should keep you out of it then. There's no point letting you in it.
Why, Stephen?
Because it hasn't made any difference.
No, it hasn't made any difference to the bus lanes, the timing of the buses. And remember, people have been standing in the city centre waiting in buses, and these people have just put the buses off without any notice. And the taxis have stepped in. Last week, during the big storm, there were no buses, no trains. But guess what, Stephen? The taxis were operating, and they were taking people to their hospital appointments and their doctor's appointments and their dental appointments. Taxis stepped up to the mark. Where was the buses at Translink?
Well, there was a risk to life, wasn't there? There was a red weather warning, yeah, and people were being encouraged to stay in.
Yeah, but taxi drivers stepped up to the mark, Stephen, and got the people to where they wanted to be, regardless of the risk to themselves. They were looking after their customers. They were looking after the public. Nobody else did, Stephen, but the taxi drivers did. And tell us this. See, I've looked over Twitter over the weekend. The cyclists coming on and saying taxis shouldn't be in bus lanes. Taxis shouldn't be this. There's politicians on Gemu this morning saying that he doesn't class taxis as public service. You know, they shouldn't be in. They're not part of the transport. Stephen, it's in the name of it. I'm a public service vehicle, PSV. I'm an integral part of the transport system within Northern Ireland.
But you know the questions that I dwell on around this. That even if you do convince everybody that you're part of that public service network, you can pedal up and down those bus lanes without anybody in your taxi, providing no public service. You would be getting special treatment as that single driver in that single car, or indeed if you have one passenger and you could have a family car sharing, dropping their kids off in multiple locations, dropping their elderly son or daughter as an over 18 to work. And you could have someone maybe distributing five or six people from a personal car, not able to use a bus lane, and you lot either with an empty taxi or one passenger in the bus lane.
Yes, Stephen, but there's a big difference. I heard somebody actually on Gimu asking, could they use bus lanes if they had insurance on the car? No, because we have had to go through stringent tests. We do CPC courses every year.
I know that, but this is a red herring.
No, let me finish.
It's a red herring.
No, Stephen, it's not. I am paying over the odds, and every single taxi driver in Northern Ireland have got hammered this year with insurance. We are paying over the odds, Stephen, and we have to get what we're entitled to. I'm fed up listening to the politicians and these cyclists body speaking about taxi drivers as if we're some, what, we're second class citizens.
No, that's not, there's nobody,
Let me finish. You can't just do it in a moment. I want to ask you a question. Right? And this is just how it is. Why are cyclists in bus lanes? See, if they're so concerned with health and safety, why are they allowed in bus lanes whenever there's huge, big buses driving up and down those lanes, but yet with all they're going to come on and complain about a wee saloon car driving by?
Well,
come on, Stephen.
You're targeting cyclists this morning, aren't you?
They're in bus lanes. Never mind about taxis, Stephen. Why are cyclists in bus lanes?
Is there any chance of... One wee second.
You annoy me.
So first of all, as I do half the country, so first of all, cyclists are in bus lanes for safety reasons. Secondly, slight red herring, you throwing in how much you're trained and all of that. The question I'm asking is, why is access to bus lanes not, at least in some circumstances, dependent on how many human beings are in that car at the time? If this is about efficiency of movement and not special preferential treatment, why is, you know, a family not being rewarded with access to a bus lane if they've got four and five, maybe even six in these SUVs, people in their one car at the time? And how do you monitor it? They do it in America. They do it in all different countries. But they do. But they do. It's called car sharing.
You're spending too much time in Santa Monica and you're looking at the wee lanes. We can go in the lanes if there's two or more.
Correct.
Stephen, that's down to legislation, but that's nothing to do with
it. Yeah, but what you want is, you want every taxi driver, whether you're working or not, whether you've got one passenger or five passengers, you want special treatment all the time. And I'm asking, how is that fair if you're in that lane, for example, the bus lane in the Ormo Road, I know it well, driving down to work. You could have a private family paying their car tax, paying their car insurance, and they could have four or five people in the car stuck in that gridlock looking at you and just you piddling down the bus lane.
Well, I'm like yourself, Stephen. I come down the Ormo Road to get to work. But tell me this. See the buses that drive around the city centre with just the driver on it. So should they not be in the bus lane then? Because they're exactly the same, Stephen. There's buses that drive up and down that have no passengers on it. So should they not be in it? Cyclists are up and down. Cyclists don't have to pay insurance, by the way. Cyclists don't have to pay anything. And you're saying for health and safety. So do you think health and safety, they should be in bus lanes? But big buses driving up and down, you've got the gliders.
Well, where else do you want them to be?
Exactly, Stephen. That's not down to me. That's down to these politicians who are experts, who are able to tell me that all the taxi drivers of Northern Ireland aren't part of the public transport system. These guys need educated. We are an integral part of the public transport system in Northern Ireland. It's us that comes out and gets the public to where they want to be whenever the buses and the trains let the people down.
Well, look, Minister O'Dowd, John O'Dowd has got to decide, doesn't he, whether he allows this, what he did, the opening up of bus lanes to taxis, permanent or not. The reason we're talking about that is, here we are now in January, nearly February, and also we're prompted by the head of TransLink, Chris Conway, saying that he has concerns about taxi drivers being in these bus lanes. Michael in Essex, 03030 80 55 55.
What are his concerns, Stephen? What are his concerns? He says he hasn't got too many comments to make, but he's got concerns. Step up the mark, be a big boy. Tell us what your concerns are, Mr. Conway.
Michael in Essex. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Stephen Critchlow. Just about the...
You're all muffled.
Muffled?
Yes.
I was okay a minute ago.
Okay, carry on. Maybe it's my hearing.
Maybe it's my voice. Sorry.
That's better
now. Just a quick point that you made there about the one person in the car. You see over here in England, buses that are out of service aren't allowed to use bus lanes.
Were they not?
No, they're not. Also, my main point was the head of TransLink. He could be dug out of his foxhole before Christmas for love nor money.
That's not true. Sorry, Pat. Would you let me host this show?
It's true.
Pat, down a minute and let me host this show. No, hold on. We're going to be fair to Mr. Conway. And in fairness to him, I heard him on the radio. He wasn't on this programme. To be fair to him, he was on the radio. I'm pretty sure Chris Conway was on the radio.
Well, if it was, it was very few and far between, Stephen. I never heard him. I listened to your show, Talk Back, and the early morning show religiously every day. I never heard him once. And they kept saying they were asking to come on the show, and somebody from TransLink on the show, and no one was ever available. If he come on, he has my apologies, but I never heard him.
Yeah, he was on this program when I was in America a couple of weeks ago as well. With Mark Simpson.
I'm talking about before Christmas when it was absolutely horrendous. I was over there for the whole Christmas period. It was terrible, absolutely horrendous. But the point about the single people in cars and things, I think that's a misnomer with the taxis, because if they have one person in the taxi, they are a public service. It's a public service.
Listen,
vehicle.
Michael, you know, many, many people, private citizens, are providing a public service when they're picking up, you know, their mom, their dad, and taking them to the doctor when they're you know, doing things for friends and family. What is the difference?
You're stretching incredulity.
Well, Amma. So what's the difference?
It is a public service.
What is the difference in Pat picking someone up and taking them to the hospital and a private citizen doing it?
Again, all I can say is you're stretching people. I mean, you're having a very sensible argument here. But you're making a nonsense up when you say something like that.
Thank you, Michael. Marty and Oma. Morning, Marty.
Hi, Stephen. Good morning.
What do you think?
I would just like to ask a question. Like, I spend a lot of time in Dublin with my work.
Yes.
And the buses
I haven't been in Dublin in years. Maybe it must be about 10 years since I've been in Dublin.
You need to get down there. Have a wee look around you.
I can bring you down a taxi, Stephen.
The bus service in Dublin is a hell of a lot better and a hell of a lot busier than it is in Belfast. And the taxis are allowed to use the bus lanes in Dublin and there is no issue whatsoever. It is free flowing.
Oh, come on now.
It is.
I'm only back from America in my wee shorts and all of that. You're trying to tell me, wind me up by telling me that Dublin is free flowing. Dublin is not free flowing.
No. Don't take me out of context here. It is the same traffic congestion as any other city has.
Exactly.
But in terms of the bus lanes and the taxis using the bus lanes, which is a discussion you're having this morning, the taxis use the bus lanes in Dublin and they share the lane and there is no issue on that score whatsoever. Certainly Dublin traffic is heavy like any other city. But in reference to what you're discussing this morning there, there's no issue whatsoever.
But what you're all arguing for here, I'm not expressing an opinion on it, but I'm marking it. What you're all arguing here is the majority of drivers, in other words, those private citizens, paying their car insurance, which, by the way, Pat, has also gone up, paying their car tax. You want them in the non-special lane and you want to be special customers. And the vast majority of people listening to this radio programme, the driving public, they're not allowed in the special lane.
Stephen, the point that Michael made there about Dublin is perfectly legitimate. What he's actually trying to say is all taxis, that's all, right? Every single taxi in Dublin are allowed to use the bus lanes. And the bus lanes flow without any problem. Yes, the ordinary motorist, people who are going to wherever are not allowed it because they're not a public service vehicle. Now, one way that we could sort this all out, Stephen, and people wouldn't like it, is to do away with the bus lanes and just let us have our free flowing traffic back and open all the lanes. Cut away, do away with the bus lanes.
Well, would that create complete gridlock?
Why would it, Stephen?
How much I still can't get my head around how much benefit are we getting from these bus lanes? We must be getting, government wouldn't be putting them in everywhere if we're not getting benefit from them. But I'm sure somebody's had a conversation.
You asked for statistics. I think before you went on your soiree to Santa Monica, you asked for statistics on the many cyclists are actually using these lanes. And nobody can tell
cyclists.
Us because... No, I'm not obsessed with cyclists.
Even
the cyclists are obsessed with taxis using bus lanes.
I'm actually being reminded by my team here that I did the very story of how effective are bus lanes. And there was a report that showed that over a 10-year period, there was minimal impact actually on taking people out of buses and trains and out of cars and encouraging them onto buses and trains. Anyway, Meg Hoyt, I'm glad that Meg is with us this morning, the Belfast Cycle Campaign. Good morning, Meg.
Good morning, Stephen.
Because you're getting hit over the head by Pat the taxi driver that wants to know why you're in these cycle lanes. Bus lanes.
In the bus lanes. Well, to be quite frank, I think cyclists would prefer their own lane. We would prefer, safe, segregated cycle lanes. But for the time being, we don't have those. And so cyclists are in the bus lanes. And that allows for a much sort of clearer cycle in, less dangerous cycle, more protected, that kind of thing. So what I'm saying is the addition of taxis makes those lanes more dangerous for cyclists, and it also slows down the buses and makes public transportation less efficient.
So what are you saying? You don't want the bus lanes?
Oh, no. The bus lanes are useful, and they are an absolute sort of backbone of public transportation. They should be free of cars, and they should be allowed to be efficient. That is how you're going to beat congestion, by getting more people out of cars and onto buses.
Pat can speak for himself, but he's saying, look, how are these bus lanes safe if you've got, even bigger than cars, if you've got these massive buses behind you as a cyclist?
Oh, for sure. Listen, what cyclists would like first and foremost is the implementation of the Belfast Cycle Network. So we want safe, segregated cycle lanes for cyclists. In the absence...
Which is even more room then for the private motorist.
Well, but I think what people are missing is that this is going to make the roads less congested. We should be on the same side. The more people who are cycling, who are on buses, are not in private cars. That's what the congestion is. We're at car capacity now. This is the best it's going to get for motorists because the roads are just full. So the more people who get out of their cars, get on buses, get on their bicycles, the better it's going to be for the people in the cars.
Pat?
Meg, I think ideally cyclists would like, by the sounds of it, there are the buses out of the bus lanes and just leave it to the cyclists. But I'd like to ask you a question. I use the Armour Road quite regular, as does Mr. Nolan, on our way into work. I have cyclists in front of me every single morning, and whenever we get to a set of traffic lights, is this what cyclists are taught, by the way? Whenever we get to a set of traffic lights, the cyclist goes up the footpath, crosses with the people who are at the wee green man, and then back down in the bus lane to carry on. Should they not be observing the rules of the road? And furthermore, should cyclists not have to pay insurance because if a cyclist hits my vehicle, I have to take civil action because they're not insured. One of our drivers was hit by a delivery guy on a bike, £1,200 damage, and what the police said, we can't do anything because this guy hasn't got insurance. You have to take civil action. He went through his own insurance company, and his insurance went up £1,000.
It's actually an interesting point, Meg. Why are cyclists who could crash into a pedestrian, and it has happened, why are they not required to have insurance if they're going to be on the road? Why not?
Well, so I think it's about overall risk. So cars are incredibly dangerous. bikes, broadly speaking, are not. If you think about the number of people who are hit by cars or the number of car accidents there are per year. So that's how insurance works. It works on risk. And by and large, it's quite rare to have a sort of serious injury accident.
But it's quite rare, relatively speaking, for someone to be, you know, injured in your private home. But all insurance companies charge for that within your home insurance policy. It's relatively rare to have your house broken into, but the majority of us have house insurance. So
Sure, absolutely. But Stephen, I mean, I would argue that break-ins are probably less rare, actually, than cycling accidents, because actually cycling is a really safe way to get around.
Well, therefore, if it's so rare, the insurance would be cheap, because insurance charge is based on risk as well. Anyway, let me bring in Peter McReynolds, Alliance MLA. Yeah. Morning to you, Peter.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, look, Minister O'Dowd's got to make a decision on this. He's got Conway, Mr. Conway from TransLink. He's saying he's got concerns with these taxis. He hasn't spelt out what the concerns are, by the way. Where does the Alliance stand on this?
Well, I'm the MLA that put the question to Chris yesterday. Obviously, this consultation for a six-month extension of the experimental traffic control scheme has been quietly slipped out by the department. It's currently live for people to respond to.
What's been slipped out?
A consultation on the DFI website to extend the measures that were introduced quite suddenly in December. I remember doing media on it, and the taxi lobby were on as well, and they agreed that this is too much, too late notice. We haven't seen any data to say that it's had a significant impact to reduce the congestion in city centre. When I asked the question to Chris Conway yesterday, if they've noticed an impact on buses, and they don't think that it's had, if it's affected, positively affected the congestion, they don't think that it has as well. Certainly that would be my anecdotal experience.
But if it hasn't affected the congestion in a positive way, has it affected the congestion in a negative way, surely, is the right question.
Well, has it had an impact on reducing the congestion in city centre? Has it had an impact on public transport? Anecdotally, myself, I would say that it probably has, because you've got more people operating in a bus lane. Bus lanes are there for buses and for cyclists to be able to travel safely. And if you have more vehicles nipping in and out of it, it only stands to reason that it's going to have an impact. So, for example, one of the measures that was introduced before Christmas was a focus on the blocking of yellow boxes. I'm in the city centre a couple of days a week for work, and I see people blocking the yellow boxes. Mm. It's going to have an impact on how long it takes a bus to get from A to B.
And Peter,
they're constantly not being able to get through.
Peter, so you live in the same bus lanes. Hold on a minute.
If you have taxis in the bus lanes, it's going to impact
Peter,
on the reliability.
You talk about those yellow buses. You live in the same country I do. Those yellow boxes. Are you telling me you don't see buses all over those yellow boxes sitting in them? Because I do.
The yellow box that I see every day near my gym, I've never seen a bus in that yellow box, but I've seen plenty of cars.
Well, Pat?
Go on to Twitter there and check Pat the Taxi Man.
Oh, my goodness. Twitter,
and you'll see all the buses you want sitting in yellow boxes. See what you're saying, that you're in the city centre now and again. I wouldn't think you'd be in 7 days a week, but I would. And I'll tell you now, there's been no difference in the hold-up of taxi drivers using bus lanes. Buses haven't been held back. Buses have been cancelled, and the taxis have stepped up to the mark to get people to where they need to be. I heard you in GMU this morning saying that you didn't class taxi drivers as part of the public transport system. I just say that's rubbish, because I'm a public service vehicle. My car is a public service vehicle. It goes through a PSV test every year. I have a PSV taxi license. It's public service vehicle. We are members.
Well, let's
we're,
let we're Peter respond to that.
We're part of the transport system within Northern Ireland. Whether you like it or not, tell me this.
Well, let's let him respond.
Cycles and bus lanes? Let him respond. Why are cycles and bus lanes?
So to come back to the point, I mean, I don't consider taxis to be public transport. I think buses are public transport because they've got fixed routes. They're open to everybody whenever they require it, and they're able to access it. There's a schedule for them there. It's public transport that allows a lot of people to complete a journey from A to B in a way that is reliable and is organized. If you contact a taxi because you're able to afford a taxi, you're making use of a private journey. Yes, they're open to the public, but it's not the same as a bus or a train.
So the Belfast City Airport is private land with public access, so you wouldn't think that was a place for the public to use?
Are we saying that Are we saying that airplanes are public transport? I don't take your point.
I never mentioned airplanes, Peter. I said the airport. I said the airport. You don't think taxis are part of public transport system? Peter, you need to go back and do a wee bit of homework. You need to read up on the legislation. You need to read up. And as far as you're saying about Minister O'Dowd sneaking in the consultation, I'm a stakeholder. I had a letter from the DFI saying that the consultation was opening. They put it on Twitter, and I think media also. I don't think it was an underhanded thing. I think they put the consultation, and I would call now while you're on. Lots and lots of politicians have did this. Whenever during COVID, whenever we were trying to get grants and Stephen was helping us, they went against the taxi drivers, and they're no longer politicians anymore. I would call on all the taxi drivers, everybody in Northern Ireland, to get onto that consultation and fill it in and send it back and let them know how strongly the taxi drivers of Northern Ireland feel how we're being treated.
Well, and I would call, as you're calling for that, I would call for all interested parties, including private motorists and all everybody in the community, if they so desire to feed in to the consultation, because we don't want one self-interested group doing. We want wider groups.
With all due respect, Stephen, I can only talk.
I know. I get it. Let's pause there. Wait a wee minute, please, Peter. Thank you. I know you have to go. Thank you so much, Peter, for being with us this morning. Here comes the news at 9:31. Morning to you. You want the Nolan Show at a different time of the day? You can get it on BBC Sounds. That's your opportunity if you don't want to choose to do it at 9 o'clock every morning, as hundreds of thousands of you do. You can listen to it later on that day. So it's all on BBC Sounds. Download the app and listen to The Nolan Show. Nolan Live coming back in a couple of weeks' time, Wednesday nights. When I'm out and about, you say, where's that TV show? It's coming back a couple of weeks' time, Wednesday night, 10:40, and then on the iPlayer, Stephen's in Mahara. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for having me on.
No,
just about the traffic congestion in Belfast.
Yes.
I'm currently a civil servant working in Belfast, although I'm based from home and I work from home. But our senior manager...
Tell you what, you wouldn't be working from home if Trump was in charge. He'd be forced
to
be in.
True. That's true. We've got Michelle and...
Emma,
yes, we've got those ladies in charge instead. But see, my main point is the congestion is terrible and our senior management are trying to phase us back into the office.
Oh.
So they're going to bring in another 2,000 cars into the city, coming in the morning, leaving in the evening. They haven't even considered the congestion and the parking.
Why couldn't you get a bus?
Well, it's not always convenient to get a bus, Stephen. The nearest bus stop that takes me to Belfast is 2 miles from my house. So if it's slashing down the rain, you're not going to
park and ride. Mahara's a park and ride where you are.
Yes, it's just 2 miles from my house. Park and ride in Mahara. So if I have to,
so
walk
you drive
2 miles
the 2 miles, you park and then you ride.
Yes, well, unfortunately, we're only a one car family, Stephen, and the partner, she needs the car to go to Korean. They haven't got a park and ride.
Did she not drop you off?
Well, it's different time, Stephen. In the morning, I would need to be leaving. I need to be getting to 6:10 bus in the morning.
But I don't, Stephen. I'm not trying to, target you here. But if you're a single car family, and that's part of the reason why you can't park and ride, I can't understand how you can drive all the way into Belfast if your partner needs the car.
No, I have to walk down in the rain to get the bus. But I'm working from home at the moment, which should be fine.
Yes,
it should be fine. But anybody that can't take a bus in has to take their car in.
Yeah.
And there's about 2,000 civil servants, maybe more, works in Belfast.
Yeah.
And that's not counting all the other offices that people work from home.
Well, you've seen, look, it's interesting. I know you're calling us to talk about transport, but you're teasing me to also talk about working from home, because, of course, that's what Trump and Musk have been going on about recently, aren't they? And there was an interview recently. I'll see if my lot here can find it, where Elon Musk gave an interview where he said, you've got quite a few of these employees who talk about their entitlement to work from home, or, you know, they need to be able to do that for childcare reasons, et cetera, et cetera. And Musk was saying, what do these people think people who work in shops do that can't choose to work from home, and people who, you know, who are dentists and hospital porters who can't work from home? How do they make their lives work?
That's the way of the world, Stephen. During COVID and lockdown, they were very glad for civil servants to go in to keep people's benefit and pensions all going. They were glad, no issues about it working from home then. But now that COVID's, well, it's mainly over, now they're trying to rejuvenate the city centres and blah, blah, blah. But they don't care about congestion. They really don't.
So how many days a week are you a full-time employee in the civil service?
Well, I'm partially retired, Stephen. I work 3 days a week.
And so how many of those 3 days a week would you want to not work from home and come into the office?
I can work quite successfully from home all of those 3 days.
Right.
And my productivity is actually better, because while you're in the office, you have colleagues coming along and asking you stuff and stopping for a chat and stuff.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen at home. You're at your desk and you just work away.
And while you're at home, are you not distracted by Judge Judy? Or,
No. You've got targets.
Or the Avengers.
You've got targets to meet.
Or bad.
You've got targets to meet, and if you don't meet them, you're going to be asked questions. Why? So the social thing is just going for a walk or what? Turn on Judge Judy. You have targets to meet, and those are recorded.
You're telling me you have never, on work time, thought, I'll watch a wee bit of Judge Judy here, or Nolan.
Well, I listen to Nolan on the radio because you're on the background. I can still work away. I'm actually working now as we speak. But
you are. What are you? As we speak, what are you currently working on right now?
Well, I can't tell you that, Stephen. To be
honest. But are you writing while we're talking?
No, I'm reading stuff.
You're reading stuff while you're talking to me. Give me the last five words.
I can't do that, Stephen.
Because you're not reading it, are you? You're talking to me.
Right. Application date 10/14/10/24. Not requested. I can't tell you any more, Stephen. Okay. It's confidential evidence.
Enjoy talking to you, Stephen.
Right, Stephen. Enjoy talking to you, but I didn't appreciate the third degree.
I'm working from home. But it's a really interesting subject, isn't it? Because there's such a... I hear from so many people saying they get far more done at home.
I personally do, yeah.
And it's just much more interesting because also of what Trump's doing. He's sacking people who don't come into work now, actively, saying they will be sacked in the next few weeks.
Well, Stephen, you've said interesting yourself debate. You've worked from home.
Absolutely, 100%.
All right, well, what's your opinion on it? Or maybe you can't share your opinion. But
I don't appreciate you putting me through the third degree. Listen, you enjoy your day, sir.
I deserve that.
Enjoy your day. Thanks for talking to us. Thank you, sir. 030 30 80 55 55. Next, new research published by the Ulster University and the Centre for Effective Services, based on the views of almost 1,500 classroom assistants, has shown that they feel they're poorly paid and treated as dog's bodies in schools. Most are employed in schools to support pupils with special educational needs. Donna is a classroom assistant. I spoke to her earlier and began by asking her what her experience has been like.
I work at in a really good school, but a classroom assistant, there's quite a lot that we undertake within the day. When you're a classroom assistant, the thing that you're thinking of the most every day is the child and the rest of the children in your class. So you just don't... I'm a one-to-one classroom assistant. Yeah. I've been a one-to-one classroom assistant for 20 years.
It's a big job you're doing. It's such an important job you're doing, Donna.
Yes.
And do you feel that appreciation back by the system, by society, from your employers?
No. The staff that I work with in the school, yes, but in regards to the education board, the government, I feel that we're completely left out and forgot about. We've tried everything, but at the end of the, we feel responsible for the children, so that's why we will do what we have to do in order to make sure that they get the nurture and care that they need. We will give up our own time. We will learn new skills. We will clean up after. We will clean them. We will do what we can to make sure the children we look after get the best treatment and access to education they can. We deal with children with physical needs. We deal with children with behavioural needs. We will train to make sure that we can, out of our own time, to make sure that we can provide the best service for them.
And so what look, I've been banging on for many, many years, since I was back in Citybeat, for goodness sake, working over 20 years, asking questions about the type of contracts you're on.
Has that
been improved now? Because you could you could be a classroom assistant for many, many years, and yet effectively every time the school term ends at summertime, you're rehired again in September, you used to not get holidays. Has any of that improved?
No. So actually, it's actually worse for me, as I have been working for 20 years, and because I'm on such a no contract, I cannot change to a 52-week contract where there's people coming in that are not working as long as me, and they can change to a 52-week contract. If I was to change to a 52-week contract, I would have to take, it would change my pay grade, and then I would have to take even less pay.
Do you mind me asking how much we pay you for the vital job you do?
It's about £14.50 an hour.
Does that sound a lot to you?
No. I have to take on a second job to try and first to make up my pay, and also to try and fill in the blanks from the holidays. And then as well, because it's classed as a second job, which you're getting minimum wage for anyway, but they tax you on that because it's two jobs. So really, I can't see, it's difficult to try and make up a loss or to make up a gain on what you're working so hard to do.
Are you tempted to give it up?
It would be very difficult to give it up.
Yeah, you're committed to it. You've been doing
it. I'm committed to it.
Decades.
I have, there's children that I've worked with that have been hospital. I've gone to the hospital. I've gone out to their homes to help them learn as well when they haven't been able to come into school. I've done extra hours that I wouldn't have been paid for children that were, whose need was so great.
So what you're essentially saying, Donna, is you just want respected, acknowledged and paid consistent with the job you do.
Yes.
Is there any hope among you all that you'll get it?
No, we don't feel hopeful at all. We probably think that we're not going to have a job. But they don't really want classroom assistants, the government, or the education board, because it's so difficult for children to get the need they need.
Well, the education board have never said that, but why do you feel you're treated as dog's bodies? Where's that coming from?
I suppose it's reflected in the pay that you're given. We don't feel that we're heard.
What would you say to the Education Minister this morning?
I would ask him to come out and spend a week working with me to see exactly what we do and how vital our role is in a school. I think that, people need to, it would be nice if somebody could see that.
And what would Paul see across a typical week if the Minister, Paul Given, did come out and be with you for a week? What would he see?
He would see that classroom assistants provide, first of all, the breakfast, the provision in the morning times for parents to leave children in earlier that are working, the same that do that. Then you have got in the classroom where you're taking out groups of children, also working one-to-one. You're also dealing with emotional needs, social needs.
And some children, because of illness or whatever way you describe it, some children who present very difficult behaviours. It's not their fault, but they do, and you're helping manage that.
You could also be having to make them their breakfast in the morning. They maybe have come in and are upset, and you'll take them and spend a bit of time with them. This is, all aside, while still trying to work with the child that you're assigned to. Then you do lunchtime and dinner time supervision too. If there's anything else additional needed done around the school, we would go and help with after school clubs. We would help with that. If there's any other activities going on within the school, like sacraments being made, or if there's school shows being put on, classroom assistants do that. Take some children, if they're going to the horse riding, if they're going on any sporting activities, classroom assistants would take them to that as well at times as too.
Well, look, let's hope the Education Minister is listening this morning. No doubt Paul would say that he appreciates what you do. He's got a tight budget. It's a finite amount of money. But let's hope he's listening. And thank you for talking to us today, Donna.
No problem. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you. Bye. Well, I know since recording that the Education Minister is engaging in this whole story about classroom assistance, and indeed the Education Authority, to be fair to them, they want to speak to you all about this morning, and they acknowledge there's a problem, and better still, they say that they are on it and they're going to do something about it. Matthew McDermott is the Assistant Director for HR Services at the Education Authority, and began by putting it to Matthew about this recent research about classroom assistants saying that they feel like dog's bodies.
So, Stephen, we have spoken to hundreds of classroom assistants and school leaders and SEN professionals and departmental officials. And what's clear is that the existing system of support just simply isn't working as well as it could. It's probably not delivering as good of outcomes for children as we would like. The staff that provide that support are feeding back to us that they don't feel valued or appreciated. So what we do know is that there's an absolute need to reform the employment model around classroom-based support.
Yeah, so there's two things in that opening address from you, isn't there? There's the system isn't right, and there is that the people who you need to implement the system don't feel appreciated enough. So that comes down to a number of things. If we look at the people, it comes down to the contracts that they're on, and it comes down to how much do we pay them, among other things. So she says she's been paid $14.50 an hour for a specialist, and these classroom assistants are specialists, to be in a room with a child, $14.50 an hour.
So there's a range of pay points that a classroom assistant will be paid across, depending on what their role is and what point on the grade they're on. So it does range from around $13.85 an hour for particular roles up to $16.83. per hour for particular roles, but you're not wrong. That is essentially a symptom of a system that we currently have in place, which relies on staff providing support to children on a one-to-one basis. It's very rigid. Schools don't have flexibility to determine the support that actually is required to meet those child's needs. And what we have because of that system is a model where staff are essentially deployed, some of which are deployed on a temporary basis to support children during the school day, and the pay reflects the role they do. But what we do know is that we need a new model. We need a model that provides stability for our classroom assistants. We need a model that has a job description that reflects the role that is carried out and is appropriately paid. We need a model that provides professional development and professional standards for our classroom assistants.
Well, you're the employer. Even if you want to do it, and it sounds like you do, you need a lot more money because the education budget's already stretched. So where are you going to, if you get to the point where you're going to implement what you sound like you're saying you need to, where are you getting the money from?
So the minister has a laser focus on improving SEN services. That's clear. The SEN reform agenda is a significant reform agenda that we will be part of in terms of the classroom based support model as part of that wider SEN support. That program, my understanding is, will roll out very soon. We're geared up and ready to go to reform our classroom-based support model as part of that programme. and we'll work as quick as we can to implement
that. Okay, but in the context of people who are classroom assistants not being able to pay their bills, that's what some of them have told me. If you're saying we're geared up and ready to go, are you funded so that you can give these vital workers a pay rise that you want to?
So any reform program or transformation program comes with transformation support. So that we'll work with the department around implementing our reform agenda. What we do know is currently in our mainstream schools, we invest over £300 million into classroom assistant support. There's significant investment already in the system. And what we need to understand is how best we can use the current resource we have. And if there is additional resource we need, we can bid for that through the normal process.
But help me understand, Matthew. I'm not trying to be clever, but this, it's an obvious question. When you're telling me you're geared up and ready to go, do you know how much money, extra money, you have to give this pay rise that you say is needed? Geared up and ready to go suggests you've got the money.
So I suppose that's an important point. We've already implemented a pay and grading review, Stephen, that you'll be aware of, that did see a pay award for our non-teaching staff. That's not what I'm referring to. It's much, much broader than that. What we need is a new model. And as part of that new model, we need new job roles that reflect the job that exists. Look, what we know is that the pupil profile over the last 10, 15, 20 years has completely changed. Today, we need a model that reflects that. What we then need to implement and put in place is a system and process of professional development and career progression for our classroom assistants so that they're well paid, so that it's a stable job, it's a stable employment, and that it's a real career prospect for people.
You mentioned stable employment. So if we go back 30 years to when I was presenting in CityBeat, nighttime show, 7 o'clock, right? Not too dissimilar. It was the early incarnation of this program in CityBeat and commercial radio. I was talking to classroom assistants 30 years ago about these contracts that some of them are on, where they can be in a school, vital work, trusted, 15 years, and they're broken up every summer and re-employed again every autumn. Is that fair? In other words, they don't get their holidays.
So what you're describing, Stephen, is a symptom of the current system that we have. And
is it fair?
I think what we've acknowledged is that it's not working. It's not the right system
to
meet the needs of children today.
But you're an assistant director of HR, so your speciality is HR. Is it fair that these people are stripped of their holidays?
So, it's not so much that people are stripped of their holidays, and I'm saying this in the context of we absolutely need to reform the system we have at the minute, and work will take place to do that. But what you're describing is different contract types that currently exist. So there is an option for classroom assistants when they're engaged in the service to choose either a term time contract or a 52-week contract. Now, there are lots of people that choose a term time contract because that meets their needs. That is suitable to their needs at home or outside work in different ways, and they choose that contract. Equally, there are some people that choose a 52-week contract. That's the choice they make at the time. That exists at the minute. That's the current process we have.
So what's the change you're suggesting in that model then?
So there's a number of things. What we also know is that the job descriptions we have, so you'll probably hear and have heard from classroom assistants that they're doing things that are outside their job description. And that's simply because job descriptions are out of date at this point and need updated. That pupil profile has changed over the last 10 to 15 years to what it was then to now. And those job roles need to catch up. The system needs flexibility. School leaders need flexibility to deploy that support across the school where they need it. And equally alongside that, what we need to ensure is that our classroom assistants feel valued through real, meaningful professional development, real career progression, and a stable contract and stable job. The system as it stands right now relies far too heavily on temporary contingent workforce. we know that's not right. That needs reform and that needs fix. And that's what this reform program is about.
I'm slightly confused by that, because you're saying that these people need, you know, stability. In other words, an assurance that if they're good at their job, it's going to continue. But if you're telling me that they can choose that all year round contract, where's the weakness in that for them?
So there's a number of things. At the minute, that the system is established in a way that support is linked to a child. So a classroom assistant is linked to support a young person.
Okay.
Now, a young person's only in school for a certain number of years, so there's always uncertainty with that. That's just not right in our view. That's not the best model. And actually, if we can provide well-paid, meaningful, stable jobs that are permanent, but it needs to be flexible because children move. So it needs to be flexible to allow us to direct the support to where it's needed within that school. And that's the aim, that's the model. And actually, when we discuss this with classroom assistants and with school leaders, they're all fully on board. And their voice is crucial in terms of us getting this right.
Have you enough classroom assistants?
In terms of the current model, there's around 22,500 classroom assistants in the system at the minute.
Is that enough?
In terms of the current model, we do struggle to recruit to meet need. The schools
are you short?
Report, but well, schools report back to us all the time that they struggle to recruit. Are we short? We do, and we always can provide the support,
right.
And that's down to the work of school leaders. School leaders. I mean, we talk to them all the time and they report all the time to us around the work they have to do to try and make sure that the children that have needs in their school get the support they need. If we can remove that burden from school leaders and say, actually, here is a model that will ensure you have this provision at all times in your school, it'll go a long way to supporting that school to unlock that flexibility to make sure that needs met. The current model as it exists, Stephen, has a lot of flaws, and one of them is we do struggle to recruit classroom assistants.
Well, look, it sounds like you're up for fundamental change, so let's follow this journey as you implement it. And thanks so much for coming on this morning and speaking widely to those classroom assistants. So thank you very much indeed, sir. Thank you.
No, thank you.
All right, well, look, we're getting lots of classroom assistants calling us. We're just heading towards the 10 o'clock news. We'll get some of you on air after that this morning. The traffic and the taxis and whether they should continue to be allowed to be in the bus lanes. You're calling us about that as well. 030 30 80 55 55. It seemed like I was away for ages, by the way. I think I was away for 3 or 4 weeks, but it seemed longer. So it's nice to be back. It's nice to hear from you all again. Don't forget, if you've got a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk. So whatever you're up against, whatever part of society you want to input into and you want your voice heard, then the biggest platform that there is in radio in Northern Ireland to have your voice heard, it's right here, 9 o'clock, BBC Radio Ulster and The Nolan Show. So nolan@bbc.co.uk, 030 30 80 55 55. And the 10 o'clock news is coming up right now. Did you hear that the news there? An improvised grenade at Broadway. What on earth is that about, a grenade? We'll try to find out more about what that's all about. It's interesting, isn't it? They found an improvised grenade. I don't know. Just a grenade sounds different to me. I have no idea if it is or it isn't. A pipe bomb and all of that kind of stuff. We'll see if we can find out more about it. 10:05. Thanks for being with me this morning. You might remember Linda. So many of you talking about her in Five Mile Town on Tuesday's show. Linda has COPD, asthmatic, and was really struggling to speak to me because she couldn't power up her nebulizer. One of the impacts of having no electric, and she was struggling to breathe. Have a listen to what she said to me.
I'm asthmatic, as you can hear, I can't breathe. It's hard to breathe at the moment, so it is. We're actually living in the living room because it's so cold in the house.
And how is this affecting your health, Linda?
My breathing. It's hard to breathe.
And how I'm hearing you this morning, and you're clearly finding it difficult to breathe because of your asthma. Is this how you normally sound, or is this different?
No, it's different. I've got OCPD as well. I can't get my nebulizer going because there's no electric.
And what does that nebulizer do? Why is that vital?
It helps me breathe.
And how often would you use that nebulizer, Linda?
I use that nebulizer twice a day.
When did your electric go down?
Thursday night at midnight.
And have you reached out to NIE?
Well, my husband rang them up and told them that I'm disabled. I'll not be on to the first or the third of next month.
That's what they told you?
Yep. It's just hard to know what to do.
Well, what we will certainly do is we will contact NIE on your behalf and we will ask them if there's anything they can do for you, Linda.
Thank you.
Look, that was Tuesday, and as I keep on telling you, you know, you keep this programme alive. This programme comes under fierce criticism from all different, you know, places. But the reason it's still here is because of the support we get from you. And when you trust us with a story, we fight for you. So we did as we promised. And Linda's back with us. And after the Nolan Show on Tuesday, Linda, NIE have provided you now with a generator. Is that right?
Yes, they have.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. The difference even in the sound of your voice immediately, Linda.
Yep, that's because I can breathe a lot better now.
My goodness. So look, we spoke to them after the programme on Tuesday. How quickly did they get up to you? How did it all unfold then?
They phoned my husband because I couldn't speak on the phone. And we had the generator within a couple of hours that day.
My goodness, really?
Yes.
That's fantastic. That's great. So do you feel a bit safer now?
I do indeed. And I can breathe a lot better.
Wow. And so are you back to... It's probably a timely point for me just to warn people about generators because there are dangers with them.
Well, we're not allowed to touch ours.
Yeah.
100%. It's outside.
Yeah, just be careful with fumes and things.
Well, we are. Don't worry. We are.
Brilliant. Well, listen, I'm glad you're sounding better. And I hope you continue to get better and better, Linda, okay?
Yeah, and the boys were here this morning filling her up.
Oh, were they?
Yep, they fill her up. They fill her up every 68 hours. They come up and fill them up.
So to be fair to NIE, when they found out, they were straight out to you?
Yes.
Okay.
It was Kevin and Aaron were up this morning at 9 o'clock, filling it up for us today.
That's fantastic, look. Good. And any sign of when your electric's coming back on, the main electric?
No sign yet.
Okay. All right. Linda, thank you very much. And thank you for trusting the show with your story.
And thank you very much too.
No problem. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Now this, I was just listening to the news at 10 o'clock there, as we all do, in the middle of the Nolan Show. A suspicious object believed to be an improvised grenade discovered during a security alert in South Belfast, police have said. Kevin Scott from the Belfast Telegraph. What can you tell us about this, Kevin? Morning.
Morning, Stephen. Yes, it was pretty much off the back of a major search operation that happened in the Empire Street area of South Belfast. That's just, if you're ever passing, it's on the West Link on the left-hand side as you come towards Broadway. It's a small area off Donegal Road.
The Balls of the Falls just before you get to McDonald's?
Yes, that's the one. So as you're coming along there...
You know McDonald's well, that corner.
I think I've known it very well too. But it's just in the small area there now. It's a row of terrace houses. Officers arrived there early yesterday morning to carry out what they call the planned search of a house. Now, when they were there, they discovered what they're describing as a suspicious object. We now know that to be an improvised grenade, they've called it this morning. Now, that operation lasted throughout yesterday afternoon with Army technical officers there, known mostly as the Bomb Squad here in Northern Ireland. They spent most of their day there alongside detectives and other explosives experts. A man in his 50s, he was arrested a short distance away, and that was on Empire Street itself. He actually wasn't in the property at the time. He had returned to his property to find the police there, and he was arrested, neighbours telling me, at the top of that street. Now, I know he remains in custody today here, and that operation pretty much spanned throughout last night. And cordons were lifted for residents from, I think, around 9:30, 10 o'clock. They were allowed back into their homes. At that stage, they'd already been out for the guts of maybe 6 or 7 hours at a local community centre, some sitting in their cars in the street. Now, there was a major search operation then took part and that was supposed to take part in that house in the early morning. That actually happened last night then when the bomb disposal team had left, and those officers who were due to search the house then got a chance to search. Now, I know several items were taken away there last night, and forensics were then given access to the house just after 10:30 last night.
All right. Really helpful, Kevin. Thank you very much indeed. Kevin Scott from the Belfast Telegraph. And look, police are warning you, do not be believing. There's a lot of online speculation, which is misinformation online around this. And the PSNI, it's the Chief Inspector Mark Conway, is saying that the investigation's at an early stage and police are aware of an accurate online speculation regarding that alert. Inaccurate online speculation. In other words, it's misinformation. It's people talking nonsense on Twitter. Don't believe it and rely on your trusted news sources if you're interested in that story. Okay, 11 minutes now past 10 this Thursday morning. Lidl are putting a pub in one of their supermarkets in Dundonald. They've got planning permission. They actually got it in 2020 for a tap room on the premises in Dundonald. There was appeal against it by a retailer. Yesterday, a judge dismissed that appeal and granted a provisional license for a pub. So what do you think of a pub in a supermarket? Does that just feel wrong? Or actually, when you think about it, well, if there's a pub across the road from a supermarket, what's wrong with it being in a supermarket? Why not? Broadcaster and journalist Siobhan O'Connor with us this morning. Morning to you, Siobhan.
Good morning, Stephen.
What do you think?
I'm in absolute shock. You know, since I've last been speaking to you, Stephen, I've retrained as a sober coach. And the amount of women that I deal with who specifically their problem with alcohol got bad over COVID due to buying wine in supermarkets, right, is phenomenal. To think that Lidl are building a pub within their supermarket, it's just, it's horrendous. It whacks of commercialism, trying to make more money off people. There's only one thing people do in a pub, and that's drink alcohol. I mean, if you want to have a coffee, but why isn't there a coffee shop being made in Lidl? Why a pub?
But what's wrong? If there's a pub, you know, across the road from, and there often are pubs, aren't there, beside all different types of shops, you're instinctively saying this is going to be more dangerous. It's going to harm more people. If someone wants a drink and they're in Lidl, they'll walk across the road to their local pub. So why is it more harmful? What's wrong with it?
Because behavioural cues, we know that when it's in front of you, you're more likely to engage in that behaviour, right? It's just common sense, but it's also behavioural analysis states this. And also, Stephen, right, think about the biggest, who are the biggest people, biggest customers that go to do the supermarket shop? By and large, and we know from the research, it's the caregivers, the ones who are more stressed. There's loads of science behind why a retailer would go and create a bar in their premises. There is no two ways about it that they're targeting, to my mind, vulnerable people.
Well, they're targeting customers.
Yeah, but
they?
I mean, a lot
and
yeah,
supermarkets target customers in every shelf they've got, in every aisle they've got. And sometimes, you know, someone like me that clearly, you know, I eat all the bad stuff of the day. I'm targeted when I walk into a supermarket, aren't I? And I'm an adult and I make a choice.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the research over COVID, I did a piece on this, right? And it was the caregivers who succumbed to maladaptive drinking behaviours over COVID, right? Specifically buying alcohol in supermarkets. A lot of the science, a lot of the research points towards that. So now you're going to make it even more alluring by putting a bar right beside the wine and the nappy aisle. I mean, give me a break. It speaks volumes of targeting a demographic that are susceptible to potentially overdoing it on drinking alcohol. Why aren't they creating a cafe there? Why? Because they're not going to make as much money. They're going to make so much more money on alcohol. And specifically in the UK, 43%. In recent survey, just in the last 2 weeks, of people, young people in between the ages, Stephen, of 18 to 34 are turning their back on alcohol. Big alcohol companies are going mad over this. They're trying anything in their power to hang on, to grip those who are still left in the claws of alcohol. And where does it stop? If Lidl are planning on a bar in their supermarket, you'd be damn sure that every other retailer is going to go the same way. And that, to me, is really going against the Sober Curious movement. And, Stephen, I think it's problematic.
Lidl told us that they've nothing further to add to this at the moment, because I wanted to know, is this a test? And do they plan to roll these out across all the big Lidls across Northern Ireland? Lidl's whole positioning statement with customers is about cheap prices, isn't it? So there are lots of questions here for our local politicians in terms of cheap drink, whether that's a good or bad thing, the adult responsibility of we look after ourselves, we choose what we put in our own mouths, don't we? However, one of the other things that just instinctively hit me when I looked at this story in the office yesterday was, what do the majority of us do when we're going to these supermarkets these days? We drive there.
Mm-hmm.
So are there going to be increased instances of drink driving now? If you're driving to the supermarket and you get tempted to have just one drink on the way home back from the shopping?
I think it's absolutely unmitigated disaster is going to come off the back of this, Stephen. I can't believe, and I shop in Lidl, don't get me wrong, it's a great shop, but why do they have to put a bar there? Why can't they put a cafe?
Because there must be consumer demand for it.
Well, that says it all as well. But if you look,
what do you mean that says it all? That's grown adults deciding this is a good product, we'll have it.
But Stephen, if you look at what's happening now, right, if you look at how the big alcohol companies are panicking, if you look at the sale of zero zeros, I mean, they're gone up 20%. Okay, they're by and large the same makers of alcohol as the zero zeros. But they're panicking now. The big alcohol companies are panicking because if there's a move away from alcohol specifically, right, from the young people aged 18 to 34, they're not getting a taste of alcohol for themselves, which means they're not going to go to zero zeros, which means the zero zeros are going to now be in trouble as well.
It's just interesting. Let's see what Robert in Belfast thinks with this. Morning, Robert.
Good morning, Steve. I think it's very dangerous for a couple of reasons. Very simple. Stephen, if a mother was bringing her children into Lidl, or even the parents bringing their children into Lidl, and then when they've done their bit of shopping, then one will have a few drinks. It's a bad encouragement there as well. And it's also how many people...
Well, children aren't going to be drinking because it's a regulated product, isn't it? Children are not going to be drinking. But the other bottom line is, look, what's this pub going to look like? Are you going to be sitting watching the match in the middle of Lidl? Yes, Robert.
Stephen, hold on a minute. I didn't say for one second the children were going to be drinking. Children are going into Lidl with their parents to shop.
Yes.
And the point I'm making is then they go into the bar. The children aren't drinking under no circumstances. Stephen, you're a type of man for twisting things to say that people are saying that they're not saying.
I think I misheard you.
The point is families go into Lidl and the parents might decide they want to go have a few drinks while they're on the premises. And secondly, they go and they get behind the wheel of the car and they drive one or two or maybe more drinks. It's faster from where go.
Okay.
It should be a shopping centre only.
Look, I think this is something we can pick up on tomorrow again, to be honest. It's really interesting. And as I was saying, I'm trying to imagine, Lidl didn't want to tell us too much, but, you know, is this going to be a full-on pub with music and telly and all of that kind of stuff? It's really interesting. And is this the start of it? 030-3080-5555. You want to give us a ring this morning? I'm sure other publicans, not Republicans, publicans, let me get that right, will be interested in talking about this. And why is it the first? This is the first in the UK. Why Dundonald? That's where I get my wee ice cream and things. So anyway, we'll talk a bit more about this tomorrow. Tony in Port Stewart. Morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
What can we do for you?
What do you want?
What do you mean, what I want you to talk about? You rang us.
I did. I told your back man there what I phoned about.
My little helper.
You called those things outside the hospitals, the balls and the falls.
Yes.
Well, that's not the people from West Bath. That's not what they call them.
Oh, is it not? What do they call them?
Well, I was on a peace wall tour in a taxi with two other friends years ago. And he's from West Belfast. And I mentioned the Bows and the Falls as we passed them. And he says, that is not what we call them. He says, we call them the Testies of the Westies.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
There you go.
Thank you, Tony. I'm educated this morning.
Great.
Thank you. BBC Suits will not be liking this programme even more now. The Testies of the Westies. There's another four complaints. Right. Listen. Serious story now. Back to the news. New row could emerge between the UK and EU over environmental tax is applying to Northern Ireland. It's called a carbon border adjustment mechanism. And you see, as soon as John Campbell, our business economics editor, hears a carbon border adjustment mechanism, that man's on the ball. The rest of us would go to sleep. John would sit up all night around a title like this. So he's been explaining to me what this all means.
This is to do with a tax known as a carbon border adjustment mechanism. That sounds complicated, but it's pretty straightforward. Basically, if you think about what's happening in the UK and the EU, it's been decided that we want to produce less greenhouse gases, we want to burn fewer fossil fuels, and therefore companies have to pay for the greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxide that they emit. However, think about imports coming into the EU or the UK, say from China or India or whatever. They don't have to produce products under those same environmental rules. So governments are worried about they might end up gutting their own manufacturing industry unless they impose some additional taxes on those imports. So what we're talking about is an import tax, which is meant to level the playing field between locally produced goods and some imported goods. The complication for Northern Ireland is it is not clear whether it's going to be the EU version of that tax, which applies here, or the UK version.
And are the two versions already worked out? In other words, what's the cheaper?
Not fully. It's a pretty complicated area. But at the moment, I think it's cheaper to emit carbon in the UK than in the EU. And I should really say at the outset that the UK government is pretty adamant that it's the UK version of this tax, the CBAM, which is going to apply in Northern Ireland. They said that last week. However, Energy UK, the trade body for the industry, for the energy industry, they've said they do not see a circumstance in which the EU would say, well, yeah, that's fine, you can do that. Because remember, the Windsor framework means that Northern Ireland is still inside the EU single market for goods. This is a tax which is very much aimed at goods, and it's highly likely the EU would say, well, hold on a minute, if the cost of production is lower in GB, and then those goods come into Northern Ireland, we would absolutely have to impose this tax on them to prevent them kind of leaking into our single market and creating unfair competition. Now, the EU has played their cards pretty close to their chest on this, but at the moment there is still this ambiguity. Which of these taxes is actually going to apply in Northern Ireland, and how is this all going to work?
If we look at the politics of this, though, and the whole row over the Stormont break and all that comes with it, The weakness in the Stormont break, many have argued for a long time, is that it allows the Northern Irish parties to ask the British government whether they will ultimately impose their jurisdiction, the UK jurisdiction. If the British government's already revealing their hand, then do we not already know the outcome? The British government, are you telling me, have they promised Northern Ireland it will be the UK version?
That's what they have said. But the experts in the area say that they don't see how the EU is possibly going to accept this, just given what the Windsor Framework does, given the Windsor Framework is all about the trade in goods and protecting the EU single market. So there is the real possibility here that there would be a clash on this issue, and it could get pretty messy pretty quick. However, Energy UK, they're saying, listen, this is fixable. There's a political fix to this, which the EU and the UK could agree on, but they need to get on with it because the EU version of this tax is due to be fully implemented a at the start of next year. So businesses need time to prepare for what is going to be a significant change for some firms in how they deal with imports.
And have we any notion how much it could be on business, the charge on?
Well, what Energy UK are saying is, let's assume that the EU version of this tax ends up applying in Northern Ireland. That is going to have implications for the operation of the Irish Sea border. And they say it could potentially do two things. It could mean that the cost of imported goods from GB into Northern Ireland would increase by up to £200 million a year. So that's a pretty substantial sum. And the other thing they say is it could have an impact on electricity prices, because the way the EU version of this tax works, it doesn't just apply to goods, it applies to imported electricity. And we know we have electricity comes onto the island of Ireland into the single electricity market through interconnectors from GB. So Energy UK are saying you could also have additional costs there, which would be equivalent to £45 a year onto electricity bills. Now, that is really the worst-case scenario, which they're talking about, if it's the EU version and nothing else changes. But they do say there is a fix to this, that the UK government know what the fix is, and it's really just about making the political decision to accept what that fix is going to involve.
And what's the fix? Is the fix that the UK aligns itself with the EU?
Pretty much, yes. And many of these things, a lot, you know, when there's potential Irish Sea border issues, its alignment is the thing which can solve it. So the simple version of this is, before Brexit, whenever carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases were being emitted, there was a uniform way of charging for that across the EU. And of course, the UK was part of the EU at that time. Since Brexit has happened, the way in which they charge for those emissions has diverged. It is that which would then create the Irish Sea border issue. So what the energy industry and others are saying is, listen, just relink the way in which you charge for carbon emissions across the UK and the EU. Bring them back together again. And then that just sorts the problem, because then there wouldn't be an Irish Sea border issue there, because any goods crossing the Irish Sea border, they would have paid the appropriate carbon tax in whatever market they have come from. And actually, we know we've had reports this week from the Financial Times that the government is looking to do that. That is going to be on the agenda in the reset talks which are happening between the EU and the UK. And certainly the Prime Minister's point man on the EU, he was also talking about this issue within the last couple of weeks, saying, yes, we are looking at relinking the way in which we charge for these sorts of carbon emissions. So, Stephen, I think it's the big picture thing here is, when we look at all this issue of the Irish Sea border and potential growing complications of that, very often the easiest fix is just for the UK as a whole to align with the EU. And we know that there's legislation in the works which will make it easier for the government to do that. But then the criticism, obviously, from the supporters of Brexit is to say, you're effectively drifting us back into the EU's orbit every single time one of these issues arises around the sea border. The easy option is just to say, we'll just align with the EU again.
John, thanks very much indeed. Thank you, sir. And that's our business economics editor, John Campbell. And that's it from us for today. So thanks for listening to The Nolan Show. All the serious news stories of the day and all the banter. It's a mix that shouldn't work, but somehow it does. So thank you very much. We'll see you in the morning at 9 o'clock. Have a good day, everyone. Thanks very much.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.